Hello, this is Teresa Ayers.
And Janet Gallen.
And we welcome you to
Love Letters Live.
As we said together.
Yes, we do. And this is a half an hour of a personal story and a love letter. And love letters, just to remind those of you, well, we don't have to remind those of you who listen to us regularly, but for anyone who's new to us, a love letter we define really broadly as any letter of appreciation or gratitude or love or flirtation or welcoming or saying goodbye, anything at all that is written in the most compassionate, endearing way, loving way possible. And that by us is a love letter. So we're going to go to our guest right now, Jeremy McManus, who is going to talk to us. Jeremy is a therapist and a yoga teacher in San Francisco. And Jeremy's life, like so many people's lives, is really interesting. And he's had a particular path he's traveled to get where he is right now. And Jeremy, I want to go to you and have you talk about how you were raised and where.
Great, yeah, thank you. It's great to be here.
I know that's a big part of your...
A big piece, yeah.
Yeah.
It is. I was born in North Carolina, actually. So I've got roots in the Appalachia.
Mm-hmm.
When I was 7, I actually, my parents and I moved to Bangladesh.
And are you an only child? You said my parents and I?
I actually have 3 younger siblings.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so my mom was pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
So as I reflect back now, I had 2 28-year-old parents who were taking 3 young kids and my dad, a pregnant wife, to Bangladesh.
Very committed to something, right?
Incredibly committed, yeah. And they...
missionary?
They went as Christian missionaries.
Uh-huh.
And they were connected to an organization out of Florida. And, yeah, it was a really exciting path. I mean, I can just remember getting to Dhaka, which is the capital. It's now, I think, a city of 7 million plus.
Do you remember what you thought at 7? We're moving to Bangladesh?
I was excited.
Oh, good.
I was. I was like, wow, like this whole other country, and I've heard about, everything's different. And I got to the, I remember when I first got off the plane, and it was just like 100 plus degrees and humidity and the smells and everything, and I was really overwhelmed but really excited.
Good for you. That's
totally.
Nice. Okay.
What year would this have been if we're not giving away your age if
you
don't want to?
No, absolutely. It was in 1988.
Okay.
So, yeah, it was, I think, July.
So what was life like there?
Well, it took all sorts of paths. I mean, we moved a lot. I actually currently live in my 27th house here in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. So I kind of bounced around my whole life.
And that was okay?
It was. I mean, it was just... It was how I was raised,
And as long as you're with your parents, you're home.
I was happy,
is that right?
I had my folks and I had the 3 younger siblings, and sometimes we were the only folks speaking English within a several mile radius, but I was fine with that, because there was time we lived in villages and stuff. But they quickly got into working with a couple orphanages. So I was always the Borodada, which is affectionate for big brother in Bengali and
say
all
that,
the
say that again?
Yeah, Borodada.
Borodada.
Yeah. So I was always...
Oh, so you're the big brother to your siblings, but to the children and the orphanage.
I really was,
So what did you do with them? And
absolutely, yeah. Well, we did a lot of English. So we did...
Teaching them.
Right, so I learned Bengali while I lived there, and which I still speak. And, we would do English and we would do sports. I'd take them out for, kick the ball or something fun after we did a bunch of classes.
I'm just interested, when a missionary goes to Bangladesh,
mm-hmm.
what's the point of teaching English rather than learning and staying in their language?
Absolutely. English is a really desirable commodity for a lot of people, anywhere in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So for the kids, for them to learn English and then also just to get an education, it was really an exciting opportunity.
So it's helpful to them. It's not just like so they can read the Bible or
totally.
Something.
Right, exactly. It really is. And one of the exciting things was to see we've actually now... There's at least one doctor that's come out of the orphan kids, and I know of several others who have moved to the States. I think we have one who's in a graduate program at Boston University.
Mm-hmm.
So it's exciting to see now, 20 years later. Has it been that long? 20 plus years later, seeing what's happened over the years.
Okay. So talk about your growing up and
you're
coming
totally.
To be who you are.
Yeah, I was, like I said, bounced around a lot in Bangladesh and, went to a lot of different schools, homeschooled for a while, and then I moved to, we moved to India in 95, is that right? 95.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to high school there, so I did my last couple years of high school in a Cambridge school in southern India. It actually reminds me a lot of Dead Poets Society. I don't know if you guys have ever seen the movie.
Yes, I do remember that movie.
It was real kind of rigid. And, it was, that was I think, a little tougher for me later in life, because, you know, there's a lot of times when I sat and thought, God, like, what are all my friends back in the States getting to enjoy that I'm missing out on? Like,
oh, you were aware of that.
Oh, totally. I'm like, oh, like McDonald's and all these things that I just want to get back to the States and enjoy.
How often did you come back to the States?
Yeah. We came back every 2 to 3 years. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think I made 4 trips during the 10 years.
And so you somehow retained friendships?
Yeah, yes and no. I mean, that's a great question. It was hard to.
I'm sure.
You know, it really
was. Did
you
write letters?
And I had quite a few pen pals, actually.
Okay.
Yeah.
That fits our...
Fits right
yes.
in. Yeah,
fits
I did.
Nicely.
I had quite a few pen pals.
Do you still have those letters?
Wow, that would be really interesting to try to dig those up.
Yes.
Yeah, because I actually know that I kept a huge bag of letters and of love letters that I wrote to high school sweethearts.
Uh-huh.
And I have a huge bag of them somewhere. I think they're in Murphy, North Carolina, so I'd really...
Oh, okay. Someday you should get your hands on those and make sure nobody gets rid of them, because you can learn a lot about yourself.
Totally. That would be awesome.
Talk about how your life went. I mean, obviously, on the road to becoming a grown man, your life has to diverge from your parents' lives
right.
at some point.
It does.
Can
yeah,
you talk to us about that?
You know, I think I really started wrestling a lot with Christianity and the way that I saw it when I was in India. Well, I think it was twofold. One, I think I started wrestling a little bit with this idea that we can go over to another country and try to tell them how to think
uh-huh.
or how to believe. That was a real struggle for me.
Sure.
Not while I was a part of it, because it was just kind of what I knew. But once I came back, I was like, you know, gosh, I feel like in a lot of ways they had so much more to offer me than
That's what I wondered around. About the language, the supposition that you go there and make Absolutely. Them into what you are somehow.
Exactly. Right. To Christianize and colonize, as McCarthy said. And it stopped resonating with me, you know, once I got back to
What
the
bothered
States.
You about it?
And
what did you learn from them?
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it was, a lot of it was a cultural thing. Like, I think, I just felt like the culture I was a part of was really rich.
Mm-hmm.
Islam is the dominant religion in Bangladesh, and I had a lot of friends who were just incredibly committed to what they were doing and what they believed in, and just really amazing
mm-hmm.
human beings. And then moving to India, I met a lot more Hindus. And again, just a really rich, and I mean, thousands of years of culture of
mm-hmm.
doing these pujas, these you know, sort of celebrations and remembrances, really incredible.
Did your parents somehow share that with you, that feeling of learning from them also? Or, I mean, how did your father feel about that?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think, you know, I think mom, I guess when I reflect back, I think dad was a lot more of the... authoritarian in the family,
mm-hmm.
and he was a lot more kind of, this is how things need to be.
Mm-hmm.
He a lot of times would be the preacher when he'd go to different churches, and definitely had a pretty firm conviction, like, around his beliefs. And I feel like mom was a lot more the, you know, educating us and being at home with us, and maybe even a little bit more flexible, you know, and I've seen that play out a little bit as she's moved back to the States and, you know, now works as a school teacher, and her and I think our opinions and our feelings and beliefs have slowly become more and more aligned over the years.
In what areas? I mean, how can
you
define a couple of them?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of it is we used to go back and forth about politics, and
mm-hmm.
and her and I now have a lot more of a running dialogue about the things that we, you know, see around the world that we don't love. Because, I mean, social injustice and oppression and poverty are things that are pretty close to the heart for us, because, you know, we saw it for... 10 for her 15 years.
So she's more conservative than you are, I'm guessing?
She definitely is. She
mm-hmm.
definitely is still more conservative. But, you know, I think when I went to college, I did undergrad in a small town in Tennessee, Carson Newman College. Kind of want to, you know, I went back to the, came back to the States when I was 17. I thought, okay, I'll go back and sort of find my roots. And of course, I got back to the States and I was like, no. Where are those roots again?
Oh.
Kind of looking around like, gosh, I'm in this, you know, I was in a small town in North Carolina called Murphy, which is where I've been born. And, you know, I felt really disconnected and alienated. I remember this one story that sticks in my mind of being at a community college I was at. And a woman comes up to me, she kind of looks at me and she's like, you're not from around here, are you?
Oh, my goodness.
And I really thought that she summed up kind of so much of what I was feeling inside. Because
uh-huh.
I was like, gosh, I feel really disconnected, and you guys yeah. clearly
can feel it. Also.
I can feel it.
That's not uncommon. In fact, there are studies done about children like you that grow up or spend a significant time out of the U.S., and they come back, and it's like they don't belong here. And
oh,
they're often not accepted by the others because the others have no idea of this worldview of things.
Right.
And you do.
Right.
And is that threatening a little bit to them? I mean, here you come, the stranger, with some other point of view.
Possibly threatening to them. And I mean, I think I felt a little threatened because I didn't kind of know how things worked exactly, you know. So I have this whole new thing to see in this perspective, you know.
So you really did come back as a stranger. That is,
I did. I came back as a stranger.
But what about the people who knew your family before you left?
Right.
She obviously wasn't one of them.
Right, exactly. And it was mixed. I mean, I came back and it was like we'd gone down such different paths mm-hmm. through our lives. A lot of my buddies mm-hmm. and friends from my childhood, you know, it was like, well, gosh, I don't know that we know each other anymore.
So how did you get to?
Get
again.
To...
Know each other again.
Get to know each other again. Most of us slowly fell away from one another.
We did.
Unfortunately. Yeah, that's, I think, I liked your question earlier about, you know, how do you keep relationships? And it was so tough a lot of times to keep these relationships over the years. Because I did. I came back in a whole different culture, a cultural mindset, you know. Mm-hmm. And I'd grown up being, you know, one of the only white kids in a country that was, you know, almost completely brown, you know. So for me to come back.
Oh, when you were there, yeah.
Yeah, so for me to come back and things be the total opposite, I was like, wow, this is so weird, you know. So I think for me it ended up being a lot of wandering for years and years until in 2005 I moved to San Francisco and I was like.
Well, I have two questions.
Yeah,
may.
Please.
How did your father, I mean, that couldn't have been easy for him as the preacher and the person who is somehow entrusted with bringing the word of Christian God to these people who, I guess, didn't invite you.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
So, obviously, he felt strongly about it. And then you're kind of, you know, wafting away from it a little bit.
Right.
What was between the two of you?
Yeah, you know, I feel like Dad and I started sort of disconnecting from one another and drifting apart a little bit in my teen years, you know, because I think I was really kind of rebelling against a lot of sort of the popular values at this conservative Christian school I was going to. And
what were they?
The values I was wafting away from?
Yes.
I think the values that you're supposed to, that there's one way that's right, you know, be it, I mean, and it's a lot of different things, you know. It's embracing, I think, a kind of a fundamentalist Christian viewpoint is one of them. But it affects so much more of life, you know, because at this place it was about your haircut and about, you know, how
many
times.
Oh, when you came back home.
When I was at the high school that I was at. Yeah. It was about the haircut and about the, you know, how many times I showed up for assembly in the morning and that kind of thing was sort of the pervading values, and I was really pushing back against those.
Do they seem superficial to you?
Just not right.
Uh-huh.
You know, it wasn't, I found myself in all these arguments with peers about, like, trying to defend my faith, and then I ended up often.
Your birth faith?
My birth faith of Christianity, and I often agreed more with the people I was arguing against than I did with my own arguments. So that, over and over again, kept coming up for me as, like, well, this isn't fitting, you know? And so it wasn't coagulating in my head the way I thought it was supposed to.
And your dad said?
And, you know, Dad and I think, really started drifting apart in those years, so I don't know how many of those conversations we got to have. He actually lost his dad when he was 13.
Wait.
Yeah.
You said you don't know how many of those conversations you got to have, so
right.
My question was going to be, did you talk about these things, and was it a basis of argument, or did you just drift?
I think a lot more drifting.
Mm-hmm.
I think more arguments in once I entered adulthood and in undergrad, I think sort of those years. I think in my teen years, it's like there's a little bit of a gap.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like there's a disconnect, you know. Whereas I think back on those years, I don't have a lot of memories of Dad in those years, which is actually kind of sad to think about.
Yeah. Could you evoke them if you wanted to?
Evoke the feelings?
The memories.
The memories? That's interesting to think about.
Now, so you talked about, okay, undergraduate school.
Mm-hmm.
Where was that?
So undergrad was at Carson Newman in near Knoxville,
okay.
Tennessee.
Uh-huh.
And that's where I think I was just so delighted to have some professors. And they were older male professors who really, I think, kind of took me under their wing. And I think I naturally sort of moved towards them, was drawn towards them because of maybe some of the absence of my own father in my life.
Had he died?
He didn't. He just hadn't been around much.
Oh, I see. Okay.
You know?
Is he
and
still
also,
living?
He is.
Oh, good.
He is
okay,
still alive.
I didn't know.
Yeah. And also to move back to the States. You know, I was 17 moving to the States alone and still had all my immediate family in India. And those were who I knew.
Oh, I missed that part.
Mm-hmm.
How was it that you came back alone?
I wanted to go to college.
Oh, I see.
And
okay.
I was ready to sort of, I think, you know, I was ready to come back to the States and, you know.
And that was okay with your parents?
They were actually pretty supportive.
Good.
Yeah, I think they really supported the idea of me going to school. And they were actually, I would say, wonderfully supportive during that time.
Oh, nice.
Mom was scared.
Sure.
For sure. I was scared.
Oh, so I didn't realize that you faced all that. You're not from around these parts on
your
own.
I did.
Yes.
I did. And I, you know, and not to say, I mean, there were definitely some wonderful people in the community that
sure.
sort of old family friends that really took me under their wing. And, God, I think back. And I'm really grateful. But, yeah, these professors who sort of gently, instead of getting into big arguments of faith with me, just ask those questions that, you know, are really, really challenging.
Was this a Christian school?
It is. It's actually a Southern Baptist school. Mm-hmm. And at that Southern Baptist school, I had professors who I think themselves were challenging a lot of sort of the tenets of how things are supposed to be or, mm-hmm. or different views. And so for me, I got just asked a lot of really tough questions.
By them, yeah.
Like, well, you know, could 5 billion other people be wrong? You know, and questions like that where it's like, wow, these are some really hard things to think about. And I ended up doing a philosophy of religion in undergrad and a sociology major. And so that really, for me, started sort of, you know, blowing the lid off of my...
That is an interesting question. Can 5 billion people be wrong?
Mm.
As if those 5 billion people are one homogenous group without...
Right. And that's the thing. As if the 6.5 billion or whatever there are... Any of us are a homogenous group. I mean,
right.
We all have just such remarkably intricate paths and lives, and, like, we all have our own story.
And that you can have shades of difference or big differences and still all be Christian.
Right. Or whatever else.
Right, but in this particular
absolutely. I mean, it's really, I mean, it's such a rainbow of colors. But,
So you got out of undergraduate school.
Yeah.
And then you...
And then I, you know, I moved to Asheville. My mom had just moved to Asheville. So she came back to the States, and I really wanted to be close to her. And so I moved back to the States, and I thought, man, she moved back to the States. I wanted to be close to her. And so I spent a couple years in Asheville working. I actually started working as a counselor. I worked as a paraprofessional, worked with emotionally behaviorally disturbed kids in the schools and in homes.
And then you went and you got a degree in...
Yeah.
What was your graduate degree?
So I came to San Francisco, kind of poked around and really wanted to come to San Francisco. It was sort of beckoning. And when I got here, I felt so at home.
Really? And you'd never been here before, but you'd heard about
it? I had never visited, actually. And I did visit the April before I moved, because I moved in the summer of 2005. Mm-hmm. And fell in love with the city and
your
ended up...
degree is in psychology?
Yeah, I ended up doing a master's in counseling. So it's a marriage and family therapy degree with an sort of a side emphasis in school counseling.
And do you have a particular group of clients?
I do.
Do you have
right.
a specialty, in other words?
I'm developing one in family therapy. So I'm now working as a marriage and family therapist intern.
Are your parents proud of you?
I think they really are. Mm-hmm. I think that both of them are. And again... And both have been remarably supportive of me sort of moving to San Francisco and pursuing this
okay.
new
That's really nice to have
degree.
That behind you. So who would get your love letter today?
You know, I really want to write one to Dad.
Good.
And I...
What do you call him, Dad?
I do call him Dad. And the amazing thing about Dad is he's not my biological father.
Ah.
He actually adopted me when I was about one.
Mm-hmm.
And he really took me... under his wing as his own,
mm-hmm.
you know, and for him to step up to the plate in that way as a 22-year-old guy and to say, man, you know, I love this woman so much, I'm going to take this boy that's with her. You know.
Oh, so she's your biological mother.
She is.
Oh, I see. So, mm-hmm. So you were,
yep.
yeah.
And
so.
I
So you were already part of that family. Uh-huh.
Right. And I grew up as much a part of that family as the rest of my siblings, you know? Mm-hmm. And, like, sometimes somebody will say to me, oh, well, you mean your half-brother and sister? And I'm like, wow, I've never thought about him that way,
yeah.
you know? And to this day, at 30, I mean, he's Dad, and he's Dad.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's, you know? But I...
What are the specifics that you respect and love about him and that you were sorry you might have missed during the time you drifted?
Yeah.
Because we talk about love letters being filled with specifics.
Right. Right, that's a great question. You know, I think it's twofold, you know,
mm-hmm.
because I think for one thing, I've had a certain amount of sort of resentment and sadness toward him for the years, especially my teen years when I felt like he was really missing.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the things that I love about him is he's audacious for sure.
Okay, okay.
Just incredibly brave, and I mean, again, to make some of the decisions he did in these countries with the family that he was raising.
Mm-hmm.
He's always had a great sense of humor, which I'd like to think he passed on to me, but
somebody did.
Yeah. I don't know that that's always true. And wonderfully supportive. I can just remember
of all your life choices.
He really has been. I mean, even like becoming a yoga teacher, like he could have easily said, you know, this really doesn't jive with me. And I, and San Francisco has its own reputation of being this sort of liberal, you know, from a lot of especially conservative perspective. It's this kind of cesspool of sin, I guess. And
evil,
so,
yeah.
Of evil. So to move out here and to have a very different experience. And he's actually come to visit. He came and visited a few years ago.
Oh, right.
So I feel like over the last several years, Dad and I have... slowly been reconnecting with one another.
Okay, so let me ask you something.
Yeah.
What's one of the first things we talk about in our workshops,
Love
Letters workshops, is what is your goal?
Right.
And this letter seems so beautifully goal-oriented.
Mm.
You have something you want.
I do, yeah.
And it seems like...
Yeah, what is it, right?
Well, you want to invite him back full force.
I think so. I really do. I mean, I think, because of some of my sense of loss... During my teen years, I think sometimes I kind of push him away, and I forget about how wonderfully just supportive, inclusive, paternal he was my whole life, especially my early years.
Mm-hmm.
So I think at some level I really want to say thank you, I've got so much gratitude. You know, he could have treated me in so many ways, which he didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And then more recently, I think, you know, to really say, you know, hey, Dad, you know, I recognize we've been on two very different paths the last several years, but, I'd like to see our paths start to align a little bit more. And maybe the places where our beliefs don't see eye to eye or where we both could share any number of negative feelings towards one another, at the end of the day, there's so much love and connection and, like, you know, he's Dad, and what an incredible thing. I mean, in this age when dads often walk away from the plate, he stepped right up, you know, and that's never not been the case.
Okay. Do you think that this distance that you had with your father during teen years, how unusual is that? I mean, teens often...
Yes, I was going to ask that, too.
Veer away.
You're
a family
especially
counselor.
Especially,
so.
Right, being in the field now, I mean, and it's like, I come by the field, honestly, I got to say, because, you know, me and my family have definitely, God, we've been through it, and I've got a crazy family, for sure. So now to sit with these families...
You got one of the 5 billion crazy families.
I do. Right. The billions, exactly.
Don't forget about everybody else.
Oh,
yeah.
My goodness.
Really.
Oh, my goodness.
No one is ever alone.
So, right? It's so true. So
you want to... I'm sorry.
No.
Yeah, it's a great question. So now to sit with so many... I mean, a lot of the families I work with are struggling with a teenager in the house.
But sounds like your dad was able to kind of live with that and accept it.
He did.
Some parents are not.
He did.
And it's my way or no way.
Exactly.
But your dad was different.
He did. And I think because he's laid back and was able to take things with a smile to some degree, even though he did feel distant at times, there was never... You know, the things I see happening in the families I work with, just the trauma and the level of isolation and disconnection that I think happens with a lot of those families, the dysfunction, you know, I think was a lot less a part of our family. And again, it's a lot of gratitude to
And it's a lot on the parents, I think. I'm not a therapist, but isn't it a lot on the parents?
So no question about it.
So this says a lot about him.
It really does.
And you said something really interesting. You were 22, and you loved my mom so much. And I don't know how old you are now, because I'm not doing the math for you. But
30.
I know you're past 22, and you haven't taken this on yet, right?
I have not.
Right.
I have not.
So I think acknowledging his courage at, you know, that's a wonderful thing to do.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for... Oh, we have a couple of minutes left. Okay,
great.
Good. I'm glad. I just didn't want to...
The time goes quick. This conversation is so juicy.
They always
I love
do.
It.
So, excuse me. And also, you talk about being on different paths for years.
Mm.
Isn't allowing people to take their own path really an act of love?
Mm.
What do you think?
Yeah, wow.
Whereas imprisoning somebody...
Yeah, and I, you know, to some degree, it's like, I think, again, it's like, it's easy for me to play the blame game, you know, and say, oh, well, he was sort of off doing his own thing and not worried as much about me. And I love what you're saying, because I think it's a reframe in looking at it as maybe he was being the space to be me.
Well,
you know?
Partly that, and you just said something that
he
said, you know, he was off doing his own thing and he wasn't thinking about me. I think when parents are off doing their own thing, and their own thing happens to be whether you feel it's a worthwhile effort or not, making the world spiritually safe and whole, as he thought he was doing.
Right, he did.
Isn't that a way of keeping your family safe?
Yeah.
I mean, what's the...
Yeah, that's what a lovely portrait. I mean, he really went to, you know, he spent his whole life, I think, in the interest of us and of, you know, how can we make this world a better place for the kids that I brought into the world? And I think his work, especially working with orphans, I mean, what an incredible calling.
Would that be a good thing to put in the letter?
Yeah, I think
anything
so,
specific?
Actually. And also maybe to say, you know, I recognize that I easily could have been one of the many kids that we took in. It could have been me that wasn't taken in, you know, because I could have, you know, because I see a lot of families, again, who sort of push their kids or kids from other relationships aside in either literally, physically, or sometimes more emotionally, you know. And instead, my experience was the exact opposite.
Okay. Now, have you ever written them a letter before?
I don't think I have.
I mean, this is going to be big for him, isn't
I think it really will be, yeah. Other than maybe, I have written some cards, but I've never sat down and put a lot of the stuff into writing before.
I think that's wonderful that you're going to do this.
Yeah.
Okay. So a love letter is just a gift. We never, you know, when people say sometimes, you know, they have a little feeling of what they'll get in return for it. And what they have a right to expect in return is nothing.
Right.
Because it's a gift.
It is.
But having said that, of course, we always hope for something. And if for some reason something beautiful happens that you'd like to share with us and that we could share with our listeners, we'd love to know about it.
Thank you.
So what kind of stationery will you use? Quickly, let me ask that.
Yeah, wow.
That's part of the gift.
Totally.
You know, it's the gift wrap.
You know, I think I'm going to have to go down to maybe Flax or something and find something.
Perfect.
Yeah, something that I think is really appropriate.
Because this letter is likely to last forever. So the paper needs to be sturdy at least.
Yeah,
you're right. Sturdy because you don't want it to disintegrate under the tears.
Right.
Yes.
Mine and his.
That's right. And, you know, people keep them and you want it to be in good indelible ink so the coffee or tea spilling on it doesn't. Yeah, so it does last forever. Thank you so much.
Oh,
so, Jeremy,
you guys.
This is wonderful. Thank you for joining us. We just have time to sign off and say thank you to all of our listeners. Please join us every week at this time. And as always, we encourage you to put your loving thoughts into words and send them while you still have the chance.
Yes, and remember that if you think you have to wait for a special occasion to write a love letter, writing a love letter is a special occasion.
So till next time, from Teresa
and Janet.
Bye-bye.
Bye.